Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fast Track. My name is Kayla Othellette. I am a first-year medical student at George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences and president of the Emergency Medicine Interest Group, or EMIG. The purpose of this podcast is to help students find out if emergency medicine is right for them and to hear from interesting speakers about their path to emergency medicine, or EM. We are hoping that this podcast, in addition to the resources on our app and website, will help better equip students going into EM for their residency and fellowship applications and interviews. Fast Track will feature fellow students going through the application process, GW residents, fellows, and attendings, and other providers in and relating to emergency medicine. Fast Track is for students and by students, so if you are interested in interviewing, contact us via the GW EMIG website. This podcast is recorded at the George Washington School of Medicine and Health Sciences in downtown Washington, D.C., with the help of our two EMIG VPs, Adam Monday and Victoria Larson. The name of this podcast, Fast Track, was chosen by our former GW EMIG president, Armand Hussein. I will be conducting our first interview with Dr. James Phillips. Dr. Phillips is an assistant professor of emergency medicine at George Washington University Hospital and serves as the Section Chief of Disaster and Operational Medicine. He's also a co-director of the Disaster Medicine Scholarly Concentration here at GW, along with Dr. Joelle Simpson from Children's National Medical Center. He is a 2014 graduate of the Harvard Disaster Medicine and Emergency Management Fellowship, and following that, he was the Director of Counterterrorism Medicine. He was also a tactical physician for the Massachusetts State Police SWAT team. In 2017, Dr. Phillips was selected as a fellow in the Emerging Leaders in the Biosecurity Initiative at the Center for Health Security at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, and he is a current senior fellow at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security here in Washington, D.C. He also has a fascinating path to EM that he will hopefully tell us more about. Good afternoon, Dr. Phillips.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here.
I'm very excited to be here on the inaugural Fast Track podcast. Thank you for choosing me.
Thank you for being our very first. So to kick off our podcast, could you explain to us what Fast Track means in the emergency department?
It means your day is going to be long. So Fast Track, for the most part, is a term that usually signifies one small part of an emergency department where there's a small number of rooms where ideally you're going to be seeing what we call level 4 and level 5 patients who are, you know, the people with the sprained ankles and the splinters and the finger lacerations, maybe an occasional medication refill. And typically we're understaffed or less staffed than the rest of the emergency department, and you're trying to chug through maybe 6 to 8 patients per hour there. So it can make for a daunting day.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So why did you go into emergency medicine, and what was your path like to get here?
So I appreciate the introduction there. That was very nice. And a good way to set up sort of, I guess, one of the things that makes my torturous pathway a bit unique. So I knew since the age of 5 that I wanted to be a doctor. That never wavered except for this brief period of 4th grade where I wanted to be a paleontologist. Then I learned that they don't actually make money, and you can't pay your bills. So when I entered into medical school, I was 100% emergency medicine. I was the leader of our EMIG group at the University of Oklahoma, where I attended. But during my residency, during my medical school years, a couple of things happened. One is that the residency program at the University of Oklahoma for emergency medicine went away. And so there wasn't sort of that resident mentorship. There were no attendings. There was no department there anymore. So I didn't get much sort of one-on-one experience during my formative medical school years. But what I had started doing at the end of my undergraduate time at Oklahoma State was I started working in a burn center. So I was a burn tech at the Baptist Burn Center in Oklahoma City, working with a bunch of plastic surgeons who did burn reconstruction. And a couple of trips to the operating room with them, and then a little bit of encouragement during my third year of medical school from the surgery group in Tulsa, I opted to go into surgery. And this was in 2005, so this is, it's hard to believe it was so long ago now. But at that time, in order to get into plastic surgery, which is what I ultimately decided to aim for, you couldn't apply just for that. There were only a few spots available in the country. I think there were 80 slots for roughly, 20,000 graduates from medical school. And of course, not all of them want to go into plastic surgery, but a good number do. And so it's very competitive. So I actually had to interview for plastic surgery and general surgery simultaneously. No plastics program wants to take someone who wants to be a general surgeon. No general surgery program takes someone who's just going to do plastic surgery afterwards, because there's some rivalry there. And so you have to keep it secret. So I was interviewing for plastics programs, and then I'd fly across the country and interview at a general surgery program. And I couldn't do it at either of the same places. So the University of Michigan is where I ultimately matched in plastic surgery, which was a really big surprise and a big shock. But entering into that lunchtime hour on match day, I knew I'd matched because I didn't get the page from the dean's office on Monday saying, it's scramble time, buddy.
Oh, gosh.
So I didn't get that. But I walked into match day not knowing what specialty I'd matched into. So it wasn't just location. I didn't know what my career was going to be. And so when the envelope opened up and told me I got, my top match at University of Michigan, which is a really strong plastics program, I knew in that moment that I'd made a mistake. Like, my initial emotion was, what did you do?
Wow.
So I moved to Michigan. I completed 4 years of plastic and reconstructive surgery residency as a 7-year combined residency of general surgery and plastics. And in my 5th year, I resigned. When I finally got done being trauma chief and all these really cool parts of what I thought were the cool parts of general surgery, and it was time to really stare down my future of plastic surgery, I realized I wasn't in love with it. I liked it a lot. But residency is a marriage. And so if you're going to go into a marriage, it's not okay to just like them a lot. You have to love it, and you have to be willing to sacrifice a lot for it. And I found I didn't love it, and it didn't love me. And so we got divorced. And then in between, so I left at the beginning of my 5th year as a chief, as a PGY-5, and I had just gotten my license, but I wasn't residency trained officially. I wasn't board certified. So for the 9 months between then and the time that the match came around again to try to get into emergency medicine, I had to work. And so a place I'd been moonlighting in Michigan was the Jackson State Prison. And so I'm moonlighting now that I'm not in residency, 60 hours a week, I was moonlighting at the Jackson State Prison doing 24-hour shifts twice a week with an interesting patient population, occasionally going into the prison blocks and things like that. So that was fun. And then ultimately, I reentered the match for emergency medicine as an incoming PGY-6, got very few interviews because despite having a pretty strong application, you only get funding for a short period of time as a resident. And I'd exhausted my Medicare funding, so nobody would take me. They would interview me, but they were like, sorry, number one, we don't want to retrain a surgeon, honestly. And number two, we can't afford you. So through just dumb luck, a friend of a friend of a friend was at the University of Illinois in Chicago, and there was a spot that opened up there, and they had funding for me. And so I interviewed, and Brad Bunny took me outside the match into their program, and I did 2.5 years of an emergency medicine residency. I got 6 months of credit for those 4 years of general surgery, and then graduated and went on to fellowship.
Wow.
That's the long, tortuous pathway.
No, it's great. And that fellowship that you're referring to, was that in Boston?
It was. So when I went into emergency medicine the second time, when I knew I was interviewing for residencies, I had already formulated a plan that disaster medicine is what I wanted to do. I'm from Oklahoma City. I'm 40 years old, so I was in high school in 1995 when the Oklahoma City bombing happened. And that terrorist attack on my hometown that killed 168 people and brought down a 13-story building that my father built when he was in construction made a big impression on me. I was sitting in Spanish class, and the window next to me just started rattling. This huge impact, and like, wow, what was that? And about 4 or 5 seconds later, we heard the boom, because the shock wave travels faster than the sound wave. And we were all like, whoa, what was that? Would a plane just crash outside? We're all looking out the windows. We couldn't see anything. And then a few minutes later, the TVs came on, and we knew that the bombing had occurred. And at that point, my father was no longer in construction. He was an Oklahoma City firefighter. So my father, who was at headquarters for his career, was about three blocks away when the bombing occurred. And so my father was the first person in the building as a rescuer on the day of the Oklahoma City bombing. And he went straight into the nursery and started pulling out kids. And so that obviously made a huge impression on me. And when I had the opportunity to hit the reset button after plastic surgery, I was like, this is my opportunity to do what I'm supposed to do. I'm the first one in my family to ever go to college. We've been three generations of firefighters. And emergency medicine and disaster medicine is basically the closest I can be to being a firefighter and a cop and a paramedic while still being an ER physician.
Yeah, that's awesome. And in terms of research, you have a pretty famous journal article that came out in 2016, I believe in April of 2016, in the New England Journal of Medicine on workplace violence against healthcare physicians, healthcare workers in general. So what inspired you to go into this research, and how do you think it's affected the way you provide care?
It's another great question, Kayla. So when I finished my disaster fellowship, I was working at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. For those of you not from Boston who might be listening, especially as first and second year med students, you have to read The House of God. It's still the book that you must read, and it's great. And yes, it was written in the 70s, but it's still really accurate, and then read it again as a resident and again as an attending. And what I'll tell you about the House of God is it's a real place, and that is Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. So it was written there, and I got to work at the House of God, which is a fun thing. So I spent 3 years as faculty there, and while still working on the disaster things and the tactical medicine things, I sat down with my mentor the day after a surgeon was murdered in the hospital at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And his name is Michael Davidson. He's a cardiothoracic surgeon that was murdered by the son of a former patient. And that shooting took place in the hospital. And at that point, I'd been writing about active shooters, training people about run, hide, fight, doing research in that area. So my mentor says, hey, the shooting happened across the street. What are you going to write about it? And I was like, well, it's not an active shooter. It was a murder. So he encouraged me to do some research and come back to him after I'd just done an overnight PubMed sort of evaluation of shootings in hospitals. And that's when I realized that this is actually workplace violence that I'm reading about. And then I started using those exact search terms, and oh my goodness, the amount of literature out there is profound, but it's all from the nursing aspect of medicine. And that's partially because most of the assaults that take place are against nurses and technicians simply because they spend more time face-to-face with patients. But then I started thinking about it. I'm like, wait a second. I've been assaulted twice as a physician. Once as a resident, I had a patient intentionally spit a mouthful of hepatitis C-positive blood in my eyes. I had to get tested for 6 months, and I didn't know that that was something that, A, is worth 20 years in prison in the state of Illinois, B, that my university should have been all over that and making sure that I was more than just medically okay, but making sure that this was being remedied and looked at from a system standpoint. And that didn't happen. But I kind of blew it off as part of the job. Then the second time I got assaulted was during my fellowship in Boston when a woman spit in my face and threw her phone and hit me in the face with it because she was dropping F-bombs in a room in the emergency department. I just stopped by and I was like, ma'am, can you kind of keep that down a little bit? I'm not your doctor, but there's a kid next to you who is my patient, and he's not quite old enough to hear you using that language. So she used the language in my general direction and then hit me with her iPhone, which was great. So she got, that was a felony assault, and I had her convicted of that. So when I realized that not only is this really prevalent, that I have been a victim of it myself, I also realized in my literature review that doctors aren't writing about this. No physicians were writing about this. There's literally one physician who had written a couple of articles about it. And so I decided I was going to start being interested in healthcare workplace violence. So I wrote up a quick blurb and turned into an outline that got approved by a journal because they were interested in it. And then they gave me a number of words and a number of months to write sort of the definitive review article on healthcare workplace violence in the United States. And when that came out, it was certainly life-changing. I highly recommend to any of you listening, if you have an opportunity to publish in the New England Journal of Medicine, do so. It's really good for your resume.
Great, thanks for the advice.
In case you were thinking about turning down that opportunity, if it arises, do so. And it, you know, it generated a lot of interest, and it's kind of helped physicians realize that there's a lot of violence towards physicians. A lot of us get assaulted, and you should know this as medical students, that you are literally statistically entering into the most dangerous, most violent non-law enforcement industry in the United States. And let that sink in for a second. No one's teaching you karate. No one's teaching you self-defense. No one's letting you know that this is a part of your job and it will be every day. And that those sorts of events that are going to happen to you are not just part of the job, and they're not just part of the nurse's job. So just be mindful of that as you're moving forward and choosing your careers.
Do you think when you're watching the news and you see something like recently there was a shooting in a parking lot of a hospital in Chicago, does that affect you more because you've studied it? Does it get you angry that things haven't changed? Do you think we're moving in the right direction?
There's a lot of emotions involved with that particular incident. So late last year at the University of Illinois Chicago, my residency, there was an there, which is what you're talking about, and I see your face. If you at home didn't know this, Kayla didn't know this when she was interviewing me, is that was my hospital where that shooting took place. And the person that was killed was a resident in the program that I graduated from. And I spent 3 years at Mercy Hospital. And so that particular shooting was very close to home, because not only is it, what was it, a workplace violence incident, which it was, her ex showed up at her place of work and murdered her in the parking lot, but then he ran into the hospital and started shooting indiscriminately. So it turned into an active shooter situation. So twofold, it was very meaningful to me just from the incident itself, but extremely impactful given the fact that my colleagues and my friends are the ones who were there.
Yeah, I'm so sorry about that. That's a lot. A lot of people listening are very unsure about what they want to do. They don't know if they want to go to medicine or surgery. They don't know if they want to be pediatricians and work with kids, or they want to be an adult doctor. So what should we be doing to explore specialties during our preclinical years to get some of these questions answered for us?
That is a great question, and it is it's sort of the biggest deficiency, in my opinion, of the current way we teach medical school. The first 2 years is mostly didactic work, sitting in a room with a book and a marker board and a bunch of flashcards and memorizing bold terms. And that's okay, you spend a lot of money to learn all those bold terms. The problem is that your third year you have these defined rotations that you have to do with minimal elective time. And that's great if you are interested in going into one of those defined sort of core aspects of medicine. But if you want to go into something like, I don't know, plastic and reconstructive surgery, your opportunities to experience that are extremely slim, if potentially non-existent. I had to wait until my fourth year before I was able to do any plastics rotations. And in that particular specialty, if you don't do at least two and get great letters of recommendation, you're not even going to get an interview. And so I think that whatever students can do to get experience with subspecialties during their third year, they need to take those opportunities. I don't think there's any reason why the structure of third and fourth year has to be as it is. You know, fourth year after your fourth year, it's, or after match day, it's kind of like a cakewalk. Everybody checks out. Nobody's doing what they're supposed to be. They're not working as hard as they should be. And that's fine. I had senioritis. Dude, I get it. You know, but maybe we should putting some of those core things at the end so that you're working hard all the way through past match day. And maybe in your third year, you should be doing more elective time. I'm just throwing that out there. Sorry if any of the deans are listening and disagree. So emergency medicine, I didn't get to do until my fourth year. Plastics, I didn't get to do until my fourth year. So I literally had to design my fourth year on a whim and choose my elective rotations without really knowing if that's what I wanted to do. Who knows? Hell, I could have been the world's greatest orthopedic surgeon. Maybe I should have been a urologist. Maybe neurosurgery would have been awesome. maybe, you know, anything, physical medicine and rehabilitation. I don't know, because I've never met any of those doctors. I've never spent 1 minute in an operating room with a urologist. So it's a really difficult thing. And it's a deficit. It's something that could be fixed in medical school. So what can you do about that? I don't know. You need to talk to your mentors. You need to talk to your medical school faculty about ways you can get involved with some of the subspecialties. And, you know, emergency medicine at most medical schools isn't even a required rotation.
Yeah.
Yet 8 weeks of gynecology is. And so when you look at the statistics of the way that people match, there are some specialties that are very, very skewed in their demographic. OB is a very clear one, yet everybody does OB. But then you've got a major specialty like emergency medicine, which is, you know, 50-50, and you're not required to do it. So there's some things that could be fixed, I think. I don't think that every psychiatrist needs to know how to deliver a baby, but I think that they should know how to apply direct pressure to bleeding and yeah. get that to stop. So that's my plug for emergency medicine. I think it should be required.
And do you think some of that, I guess the lack of love for EM in the required rotations, do you think that comes from the fact that it is kind of a newer specialty that was developed in the late 70s or formalized in the late 70s, or do you think it's something that, something deeper than that, I guess?
Two things, and they're related, and that's a stellar question because I love this. So emergency medicine, we celebrated our 50th anniversary of the formal founding of the American College of Emergency Physicians this year. So 50 years as a specialty sounds like a lot, but compared to the only thing really newer than emergency medicine is like radiation oncology. There's very few things that are newer than emergency medicine. The way it all started was a hospital might have a hearse that would go out, or an ambulance is what they turned into, but they would have a hearse that would go and pick you up at your house if you called and you were sick. They would bring you back. They might bring you to a room. There would be an off-duty surgeon, an internist, maybe the ophthalmologist, maybe the dentist that day, had to do their required 1 day in this room where they're seeing incoming patients. And that's where the concept of the emergency room started. And throughout that last 50 years, we realized, hey, this is a real specialty. We are not just the off-duty doctor that is coming in and sitting there, and you're seeing all these things that have no relation to your own specialty. You know, someone with chest pain should not probably be taken care of by a podiatrist. Someone with a broken toe should not be taken care of by a cardiologist. It's pretty simple. So emergency medicine is new, and you'll certainly find some older doctors and people in healthcare that have been around long enough before emergency medicine had any real ground to stand on. When I was in Boston in that particular system, Harvard did not have a department of emergency medicine in its medical school. All the emergency medicine physicians were in the Department of Medicine. It was that way until 4 years ago.
Wow.
4 years ago, Harvard finally created a Department of Emergency Medicine. So yes, there is some certain ingrained sort of old school mentality that goes that way. And that's important because when you have an emergency medicine assistant professor or associate professor looking to get promoted, you need to be promoted by your peers, not people in a different specialty. So until then, emergency medicine promotions would be done by medicine doctors. And so, yeah, there's always interesting interactions like that. And then in addition to that, I think that one of the reasons emergency medicine, I won't say that we're not respected, but it could be better. And I think that a lot of that is our own making. Most folks that go into emergency medicine are on the casual end of things when it comes to formality. We like to get together, we laugh a lot, we cuss a lot at work. You know, we tell bad, horrible jokes that can be dark, but it's part of the way that we bond and that we see, you know, through the darkness and maintain our sanity. And I think so there's a very particular personality that goes into emergency medicine, particularly if you have a short attention span, which is great. So we don't take ourselves as seriously and formally when maybe we should. We're also not an ologist. So we're not a urologist, a neurologist, a cardiologist, any of these things that end with IST. we just call ourselves ER docs, right? And it's not taken as seriously. It's not a term. If you go to Europe, you're an emergentologist, and we think that's silly for the most part. But I think that there is a casualness that we have amongst ourselves that spills over into other specialties to where they don't take it quite as seriously. And the way I like to ingrain it into my residents is that other specialists, clinics, people out in the community with offices, if you're sending your patient to the emergency department, don't send them there because they need a CAT scan or because they needed this antibiotic or because they need this. I don't work in that way. You don't send them to me to do your work. What your concern is you have a patient that you're concerned there might be an emergency. So you want to send them to an emergency consultant to determine, is there an emergency? And if there is, please treat it appropriately and then call me back, right? So we are consultants just like any other specialty is. When I call a gynecologist down to the OR, or to the ER, when I call a neurologist down to the ER, it's exactly the same as when someone is sending a patient to me. It's just that I sit in one department and don't move around a lot. So I think that if we want to change sort of the way that emergency medicine is viewed, because we're not all cowboys, we're not all, you know, flunkies in med school, and a lot of us do real research. So I think that the ways that we have to change that sort of culture and that mindset externally is just to watch how we refer to ourselves amongst other doctors, and to stand up for ourselves whenever people are sending people to the emergency department. Just remind them, hey, I'm a specialist, and you're sending them, you're consulting me for to find out if there's an emergency.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about subspecialties, et cetera, but a lot of people don't know if they want to do a fellowship or what that even means. Can you explain to us what that means in terms of when we should start thinking about whether we want to do one or not?
Yeah, think now. Yeah. Now, honestly, I remember being done with medical school before I even knew really what a fellowship was. But the easiest way to think of it is the traditional fellowship way is that if you want to be a gastroenterologist, you don't match into gastroenterology. You match into internal medicine. You finish that medicine program. During the, you know, end of your residency, you're applying for fellowships in gastroenterology. So it's not just about getting a great step one score. It doesn't make you a gastroenterologist. It gets you into the right medicine program. And then you have to continue to be awesome at residency and awesome at your exams during residency in order to match into a fellowship. Not all fellowships are competitive. Not all fellowships, like I said, are accredited. So some are very strict and regimented with a certain amount of pay and a certain amount of hours, and then others are much more free.
So the MS2 students right now are locked away studying. You saw Armand a second ago. He came by to say hi before we started. But do you have any advice for those who are studying for STEP right now?
I wish that I didn't have to say this, but it is the most important test of your career. I wish it wasn't that way. I wish that during your second year, you were allowed to be more engaged in your education, be able to be out doing extracurricular activities, but instead we are locked away for 3 months to study for this exam. And I wish it wasn't that way. But there has to be some way to separate out and stratify students as to how academically, how good they are. And I don't know of a better way to screen people for programs, for residencies, other than that test. It's unfortunate, but the reality is if you are, for instance, an emergency medicine program at a top hospital and you have 12 slots and you're getting 2,000 applications or 1,000 applicants, you can't look through all of those charts. You can't read all those letters of recommendation. You can try, but you have to have a cutoff somewhere. And so every program is going to make a cutoff with a board score, and that's where you're going to drop off. Now, you can make up for that with step two. You can make up for that with good letters of recommendation, with honoring and all sorts of areas, but it's certainly going to be difficult. You know, in my initial residency interview process, you know, I had a good score, and if I hadn't had that score, there's no way this kid from, a mid-tier medical school was going to get interviews in plastic surgery at places like Michigan. So unfortunately, that is the most important test of your career. And you had mentioned Armand. You know, he and I have been working on a research project together for a year, and he has a three-month hall pass right now because I need him working on that to get his career where it needs to be, not working on my project. So study, study, school's your buddy.
Love it. And there's also, I mean, there's always rumors circulating about any application process. But one rumor that I've heard in EM is that step two matters more than step one. Is there any basis for that at all? Why does that rumor exist?
That rumor exists for people who did poorly or on step one.
Okay.
It, like I said, there is a way to make up for a step one exam score that you think is not your best score, and that is to do those things. Step two, show some real improvement, and then you explain, hey, I had a bad day. I had a bad test day. But you can see from all these other things that clearly I know my stuff. That statement feels good, but the reality is step one is still step one. Because if you kill step one and you don't do as well on step two, I haven't seen any place where that's a big deal. I'm sure there are those places, but work hard on step one.
Gotcha. All right, so say I am an MS3 and I've always been sure that I was gonna go into emergency medicine. And now I am torn between medicine and surgery, and I don't know what I want to do, and I'm freaking out. I might be referring to a specific MS3 I'm asking this for. Yeah. So what would you consider if you're making that decision?
She and I talked about this at length at our last major event, the Women's March, where we sat in a tent and talked about this for a while. So I do know who you're talking about. Hey, B. It's a very difficult decision, and she's not the first to come to me for that advice, and it's hard for me because I love emergency medicine. I love the opportunities that emergency medicine affords me, and I love all the things that are quasi-emergency medicine that are outside the hospital that I get to do, whether that's events, Iraq that I go to, like all these are sort of cool things I get to do that I wouldn't have gotten to do if I was a surgeon. My hours are better than a surgeon's. I don't carry a pager. I don't get woken up in the middle of the night ever for a patient, only for my 9-month-old boy. I can leave town whenever I want to without having to worry about rearranging clinic appointments, canceling the operating room. I can move to a new town and start a new job tomorrow. I don't have to worry about opening up a clinic, hiring staff, paying staff, running a business. I don't have to worry about that. If I was an academic surgeon, I don't have to worry about taking trauma call, all these sorts of things. So it's the residency is difficult, either route. The residency is longer for surgery, but you shouldn't let the length of a residency or the difficulty of a residency dictate what you choose to do for a living, because every specialty is much different when you're on the other side. That being said, residency is a marriage, and if you don't love your spouse, it's not going to end well, and nobody wants to be a terrible husband, and so you have to have that sort of come to Jesus moment where you decide, is this really what I want to be for a living, or is it what or do I just like the idea of being that for a living? I loved the idea of being a burn surgeon. I loved the idea of dedicating my career to secondary burn reconstruction. The reality of it is just not that. There were maybe three places in the country I could get a job that would let me do that full time in a major burn center. I could never move. I could never go start a private practice. And so I had to look beyond residency and really look at the lifestyle opportunities beyond that. And that's what I would encourage people to do, is to not just look at that 5 years of residency and how hard it's going to be, but look beyond that to make sure that you want to be tied to a pager for the rest of your life, or your Tiger Text or whatever we're using here. Because I can tell you, for 4 years, I took Q3 call for 4 years, and I was virtually homicidal when my pager would go off in the middle of the night.
Oh, God.
Because we took home call.
Yeah.
And so we would have to drive into the hospital and see every single thing that came into the emergency department. And 7 years of that was a really long time. And I know I just said, don't let your residency dictate what you do. But there are some circumstances where that does encourage you or discourage you. So for those of you out there interested in making that big decision, it's clear that you like using your hands, you like fixing things, you like procedures, and you like short interactions with patients, while they're awake anyway. The differences between the two are where you really have to explore to help you make the difference, and you have to be really, really honest with yourself. If you're saying you want to go into a specialty, but there's this real deep, dark space in your heart that no one else knows is there, that turns your stomach a little bit and you're filled with doubt right in that little spot, listen to that little spot because it might be true.
Is that the little spot that you felt on match day a little bit?
That is exactly what I felt on match day.
Okay, got it. And so for the MS4s, they are starting to think about intern year as they're finishing up or they're in the middle of their interview season. When you're transitioning into your intern year, what should you be thinking about? Do you have any pearls of wisdom on how to do well during your intern year?
Yes. And I don't think I was the world's greatest intern as a surgery intern. No attending was beating down the door for me to come in and be their intern. I was the first class in the 80-hour work week. So we were the first ones to be, you know, princes and princesses in the minds of our attendings and other residents. So they just thought that, you know, we were lazy Gen Xers who should still be working 120 hours a week.
And so, yeah, so for those of you listening who don't know about the 80-hour work week change, basically now it's capped. So you're not going to be working those 120-hour work weeks.
You are not going to be logging those hours in your logging system that you worked over 80 hours a week. I'll be very honest with you.
There we go.
Be honest with you there. every program's different, but just don't expect to go into surgery and work 80 hours a week. The fourth year's transitioning in, first and foremost, enjoy what time you have left before residency. Get a tan, go on a vacation, spend time with your family. But most importantly, understand, especially in emergency medicine, but also in all specialties, is you have two jobs during your first year of residency. During your internship, you have two jobs. The first one is to make me trust you. I don't care if you have an encyclopedic knowledge of spinal epidural abscesses. I just need to know that when you walk out of that room and you tell me about that patient, that I believe you, that I know you did the physical exam, that I know you were pushing on their spine and testing the strength in their toes. I know that you were doing those things. And that if I ask you that question and you didn't do it, that you're like, you know what? I didn't do that. I'll be right back. But don't ever, ever, ever lie to your attending, and understand that you are under a microscope that whole first year. And once somebody doesn't trust you with their patient, it's really, really difficult to make that up. So your reputation is critical. Make me trust you. And your whole point in that first year of emergency medicine is to learn the difference between sick versus not sick. And there is a, you can be not sick and still have an illness and require antibiotics and those things, but you're not septic. You know what I mean? So there's a difference is to walk in the room and be like, oh man, this person is sick. I need to go do something right away. So that's your first job, sick versus not sick, and make sure everybody trusts you.
Okay, thank you. And so to wrap up, I have a couple fun questions. So you kind of answered this question, maybe, I'm not sure, but what is your favorite book?
Oh man. That's tough.
Not the House of God.
Not the House of God. You know, A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson is fantastic. It's this really, it's the only book that's ever made me laugh out loud. It's called A Walk in the Woods about the Appalachian Trail. And anything by Tom Clancy. I know that dates me a little bit, but Tom Clancy was an incredible author. Jack Ryan is my favorite character of any character ever written, and so much so that my son, John Sebastian Phillips, is nicknamed Jack, and that's what we call him. So that's an honest-to-God truth. He's named after Jack Ryan. So I would say The Hunt for Red October is probably the best book that he ever wrote. It was good enough that he got called before Congress to find out if the things he wrote in there, how could he have possibly known those things? Because he guessed at a bunch of classified stuff and was right, goodness, yeah. And Congress called him in there to find out. So anyway,
wow.
Read Tom Clancy. It's great.
Got to. So what shows do you watch? Do you have time to watch shows?
Oh, yeah. I'm attending. I have lots of time. Kidding. Game of Thrones is the greatest thing that's ever been made on TV in the history of the world. And I'm about to start that marathon leading up to April. House of Cards was really good for a few seasons. I really like this weird show that everybody will laugh at. It's called Forged in Fire. It's on the History Channel, and it's about knife making and sword making, and it's a competition. Really silly. Those of you who watch it are sitting out there nodding right now going, oh, hell yeah, that's awesome. This guy's awesome. That guy knows that stuff. And the rest of you can think I'm a moron. That's fine. But if it ever comes on, you should watch Forged in Fire.
Great. Thank you. Definitely check it out. And what is your favorite movie?
I hate to say Star Wars, so I won't.
Which Star Wars, if you were going to say Star Wars?
Come on, there's only one Star Wars, and that's A New Hope, Episode 4, and then Empire is the best one, and then Return of the Jedi was the best after that. The three prequels don't really exist. I just choose to ignore that they were ever actually made. And the new ones are pretty good. I don't know. That would be the first thing that just comes to mind.
Gotcha. Yeah, thank you. That's it. Would you like to add anything in terms of advice for us students going through our first year?
No, you guys have worked really, really hard to get where you are. Just do your best to make friends with the people in your class. I'm surprised with how few people I actually talk to for my med school class. And I think it's because we all got in there and we're all uber competitive and everybody's a gunner. I don't know if you guys still use that term. But yeah, everybody's a gunner and everybody's trying to do well. And I think that can be to the detriment of your time here. Get involved with non-academic things like EMIG. Get involved with, event medicine here at GW. Come do a marathon with us. Come do, a protest with us and run medical stuff out of a tent. Come participate in those activities with us and do them with whatever specialties you're interested in. And do medicine outside the hospital. Just put some boots on, something you have to carry a backpack with supplies in, and just find a way to make that work. But really, I guess all in all is try to develop your friendships in your med school class because they are important, and you want to be able to stay in touch with those folks as you get older.
All right, thank you, Dr. Phillips. Those are all the questions I have. So thank you to our listeners as well for joining us for our first Fast Track episode.